The World's Fair Podcast, Episode 21. In this episode, we once again talk with Bill Cotter, this time about the 1962 World's Fair held in Seattle, also known as the Century 21 Exposition. Also in this podcast, John calls us from the Expo 2010 site in its last week, where he tells us about his experiences there and talks with previous guest Peter Sams of the Australian Pavilion. Welcome to the World's Fair Podcast, Episode 21, and the number 21 will play itself out in this podcast in perhaps a few ways. It's Episode 21. It is currently, at least in the United States, October 22nd in Australia, and we are going to be talking about the Century 21 Exposition. But first, I want to introduce my co-host, John. How are things in Australia?
So how are you?
Pretty good. Things are getting colder here in the Northern Hemisphere, and San Francisco is no exception right now. We've gone from our 1 week of summer that we had in October, and now we've plunged right into winter. We have our first return guest this time. Listeners to the podcast might remember Bill Cotter when we talked about the Expo 86 in conjunction with the Vancouver Winter Olympics. And Bill has just put out a new book called Seattle's 1962 World's Fair that's part of the same Images of America series. And we're happy to have Bill back on the podcast. Hi, Bill.
Hi, it's great to be back and nice honor to be your first returnee. Thanks.
Well, if it's up to me, we'll have you on repeatedly, because you keep on putting out book after book, and there's like so much to talk about with these past World's Fairs. And this year, for at least me, has been all about 2010, so it's kind of nice to sort of take a breather and look back and from the 21st century at what, well, there's another 21, on the Century 21 Exposition. So you want to tell us a little bit about the book, and I don't know if you told us last time about how you got involved in the whole Images of America project, but if you can tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. The 62 World's Fair had been one that was of interest to me. I had not gone to it myself. I was only 10 years old when it came out, but I had an aunt who traveled a lot, and she'd gone to Expo 58 and shared her guidebook and stuff with me, and then she went out and saw Expo 62. And it was just, it was something I always liked over the years. And I guess the thing that I, always wanted to do for years and years and years was finally go right to up the top of the Space Needle. And it was just an iconic sort of image that I was always interested in it. Finally did get to go to Seattle a number of times and go and see the Space Needle. And the more I talked to people and thought about the fair, it just kind of hit a special little niche for me that it wasn't, one of the mega fairs. It wasn't a huge fair, but it was an enormously successful fair, and one that still made a big difference on the host city. So when I finished the last book on Expo 86, and trying to figure out what you want to do next and where you want to turn to, Century 21 had just been calling me, but it didn't have quite the right mixture of pictures. It was one of those conundrums where you have 20 pictures of the same thing and none of something else. And I mean, like everybody that went there, of course, took pictures from the ground looking up the Space Needle, but pictures of the other things were a little harder to find. And one month, I happened to have a very lucky month in my collecting. I ended up with quite a few photos that I thought were on the unusual side, including some of the construction of the fair. And I just said, I think there is a book in here, and started doing more research and more, sourcing of photos and looking around and, convinced Arcadia that it was time for another one. And there it is, another book.
Well, that's great. For me, there's a connection between Expo 86 and this one because when I was 19 and I flew out to Seattle to then drive up to Vancouver for Expo 86, I made a point of stopping by the site of the 62 World's Fair. And unlike a lot of the like former Expo sites I've been to, this one, people still kind of go to the 62 World's Fair. I mean, even now, people, it's still very much in people's consciousness, you know, in Seattle and people who visit Seattle, that in a weird way, that Expo still sort of lives on because so much was left behind.
Yeah, that's one of the things that appealed to me. As I mentioned, I had wanted to go there, and I had a job that took me to Japan quite often. And one time, as the way the flights went, I couldn't get a flight straight from L.A. to Japan, but there was a flight out of Seattle. So I said, well, rather than just fly up to Seattle, change planes, and go to Japan, why don't I fly up to Seattle in the morning, spend the day there, and then I can go out to Japan that night. And flew up and stopped by the fairgrounds. And I was amazed how much was still there. You know, after being back at the 1964 site so many times, you know, where I grew up, and seeing how disused that property had become, and how a lot of people, if the Unisphere was gone, they wouldn't even remember there was a World's Fair ever there. And other cities like, you know, New Orleans, there's hardly a vestige of their fair. After seeing a number of those cities and how they had walked away from the fair, I was very, very impressed by how Seattle was still using the facilities built for the fair, and was still a very vibrant part of the city.
So, if you could go back in time and visit it as a 10-year-old, say it again. If you could go back in time to your 10-year-old self and visit the fair, what would be the first thing you would run to? Because you know you're 10 years old and you can run.
Yeah, well, hopefully I can still run a little. Probably not quite as fast or as long, but. I think I would have probably gone to the Ford Pavilion. I really like the design of the building, kind of a geodesic dome, not as elaborate as the one at Expo 67, but kind of a unique structure. And also had a show that was kind of interesting about, you know, the predictions of traveling in space and that sort of thing. So that probably would have been the first one that I would have run to. There's others, of course, of great interest, but maybe I wouldn't have run into them because I've seen them, you know, in today's incarnations or whatever. But Ford was always something that just kind of struck me as, space-age Jetson sort of architecture, Jetson sort of projection of the future. And I think that would be one of the first ones I would have made a beeline for.
That's interesting. I'm familiar, of course, with the Ford Pavilions at the New York World's Fairs and other expos, and I'm very familiar with the Century 21 exposition. But in my mind, I can't even think about what that pavilion looked like because it didn't live on. So for those of us who are familiar with Seattle and know the site really well, at the 62 World's Fair site is now called the Seattle Center, and the Space Needle is left behind, and the monorail is left behind. And the U.S. Pavilion is now the Pacific Science Center. And the International Fountain is still there. And the Food Court, which is a pre-existing building, it's still there and serves as a food court. So there's still a lot left behind. Where did and some of the other buildings were sort of reused as well. Where was the Ford Pavilion and all of that?
Pretty much just next to the U.S. Science Pavilion. It was tucked in the very far corner of the fair, next to a street called Broad Street and Denny Way. So it was over in the south side of the fair. It actually survived after the fair and became I think it was a boat dealership building for quite a few years until they finally had to scrap it. But it was, again, just a silly sort of thing. You just looked at it and said, wow, that's different. You don't see too many geodesic domes on the average city street.
Okay, I think I have an idea of where that is. That's not too far from the Space Needle, which of course everyone's familiar with. As with these, in popular culture in the U.S., you know, the Space Needle, of course, is synonymous with Seattle now, and it seems like when people talk about World's Fairs of the past, that's one of the ones that they tend to actually remember. I'm curious though, John, is there much sort of awareness of that expo in Australia?
Well, we've had a bit of a hiatus with regards to world expositions, in the sense that, we had a few in the late 19th century, and then we had nothing until Brisbane's World Expo 88. And in the lead up to Brisbane's World Expo 88, there was quite a lot of public relations working towards just raising the general awareness of World's Fair history for the citizens of Brisbane. But I think a lot of that was centred on the Universal Expositions, and of that, particularly the 1851 London Crystal Palace exhibition was talked about a lot, and also the earlier Australian expositions of 1879 Sydney, 1880 Melbourne, and 1888 Melbourne, but not so much the other expositions of the 20th century. So, but I do think that the Space Needle has entered into the public consciousness as an icon, but once again, I would doubt whether many people would be able to recognize that as actually from a World's Fair.
It's such a great building. I mean, other cities have their towers, you know, whether they're observation towers or radio towers or something, but most of them are just like big pillars and a building stuck on top. The just the sweeping lines of that structure, I think, from it's a beautifully designed building. I think they just did an outstanding job on it, and hats off to the designers of it. I think it looks as futuristic today, to me at least, as it did back in 1962.
And it was kind of a last minute addition, wasn't it? If my memory serves.
Yeah, it was a big discussion about what would be the centerpiece, the icon of the fair, and there were a lot of different structures that were bandied about. The early designs were far different than the one that was originally built, but it was actually built by a private corporation, not built by the fair itself. So that was part of the issue. They had to come up with funding, a site that was in the middle of the fairgrounds but not owned by the fairgrounds. There were all sorts of legal battles and issues that had to be dealt with, and it was one of the last things actually finished just literally the day before the fair opened.
Huh. So, and how the sort of fair is remembered today, I was sort of sitting down thinking about this in the last few days, and there's the Elvis Presley movie, It Happened at the World's Fair, which shows a lot of the old fair site, and there's a sort of famous Bell Telephone short movie called Century 21 Calling. Have you seen either of those?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I love the Elvis movie. I mean, it was typical silly Elvis stuff, but talk about outstanding views of the fair. I was always very jealous as a kid that the 62 fair got all the attention from the movie, and that I kept wishing they'd done it at the 64 fair. But there's outstanding footage in the movie. So many of Elvis's later movies, he didn't even go on location. They just stuck him in with rear projection and that. But he spent a week there in Seattle at the fair. And it was a big thing for Seattle, with him coming to town, and I think the movie just came out very, very well in it, not just as a Elvis movie, but also as a fair movie.
Go ahead.
And then, Century 21 Calling. I used to work for AT&T, so I have a bit of nostalgia for that film, and it's just great, great fun again.
So there's a couple of things, little trivia things that I seem to remember about the Elvis Presley movie. I don't know if you happen to know them.
First one would be Kurt Russell.
Yes, I was going to ask you if you knew that.
Yeah, I mean, Kurt Russell, I think, was one of his first, starring, if you can call it a starring role, but something where he's featured. And he gets the enviable task of, kicking Elvis Presley in the shin. Elvis pays him to lightly damage him so he can get the attention of the fair's nurse, and I guess he actually really gave him a good one. It was funny again when you think about years later how Kurt Russell ends up playing Elvis in a movie like that.
Yeah, when I saw the film a few years ago for the first time, I was like, wow, that kid looks like Kurt Russell, and then I looked it up, and sure enough.
Yeah, evidently the story goes that he wouldn't kick him hard enough, that he was really afraid of hurting Elvis, and Elvis basically had to take him aside and talk him into it. But I can imagine the trepidation of some kid getting told back then that you got to go and kick Elvis Presley in the shin. That it would have been a little imposing sort of task to do.
But and the little girl that was in the movie, do you know where she ended up?
I heard, but I don't recall. So why don't you refresh my memory?
She became the first lady of Hawaii.
That's right.
Yeah, the wife of the governor in Hawaii. So it's kind of funny to sort of see this little girl in the movie and knowing that she has other things ahead of her as well. You know, I hadn't seen that movie until just recently, and of course, so much has changed since 1962. It's like you would never be able to do that movie today, just because, you know, any other, you know, if the Elvis Presley character were to do what he had done in the movie, the first thing that nurse would have done would be to call the police and have a restraining order put on him.
Yeah, there are so many things like that. When I watch the movie and he just decides, oh, I'm going to go into the World's Fair in the middle of the night, and he just hops over the fence, you know.
Yeah.
It's time to go home, he just hops over the fence and saying, yeah, that would be great. Or you don't have the average person saying, hey, I'm having a tough time today. Would you watch my my daughter, and I'll catch up with you later on.
Yeah.
Think of, yeah, it's,
1962
it's fun,
is
though.
Either a different era or they had very... incorrect expectations of how people would behave.
Yeah, it had such good footage of the fair, though. I mean, the closing number where the whole marching band is marching through the fair, and you know the music's going, and Elvis is singing and everything. I enjoyed that, but I also enjoyed it just because you can stop frame the movie and just get the details of the fair and that sort of thing. So again, I'm so glad that they actually did it on location, just didn't do a Hollywood cheat on it.
Yeah, and there are some really great shots of the fair. Now, the other film which we talked about, The Century 21 Calling, I think that became well-known because of the Mystery Science Theater 3000 version of it. Have you happened to have seen that?
I saw it years ago, and I don't recall it too well. But, to me, being a fair nut, I said I was sort of sacrilege, so I probably didn't enjoy it as much as some other people. But
I have to admit I enjoyed it, and the only reason I mentioned it now is so I have an excuse to put it in the show notes.
Oh, good. Well, I ought to go back and rewatch it and see how it looks now.
So I'll put that in the show notes, just because I think it's really funny. So we talked. You talked a little bit about the Space Needle and the Ford Pavilion. Did you get to find out much about the monorail that was there and is still there?
Yeah, it was interesting. I'm a big monorail fan. When I worked for Disney, it was always a thrill to be up front of the cab of the monorail and that. But I had not ridden the Granddaddy, the Seattle system, of course, until I got out there for my first trip. And it was thrill to go to downtown Seattle, board a monorail, and actually be riding on city streets. This is the whole forecast that people, of course, today would all be riding monorails down the middle of our highways. So it was built as a prototype with the concept that they would be selling these things all across the country, and that people would be lined up for it. Disneyland already had its monorail, but people viewed it as a theme park attraction or kind of a toy. So the Alwick people really thought, by putting one down the middle of a city street, making some actual public transportation on it, we can prove the point on it. And they spent a fair amount of money on it, no pun intended. I have the number in front of me. I don't recall right offhand. But they really spent a lot of money on building that system to try to act as a sales tool. And unfortunately, cities just still have not embraced monorails. It's still running. They've had some unfortunate mishaps over the years, and everybody says, oh, my God, monorails aren't safe. But when you think about how many miles that thing has gone and how few accidents they've had compared to, these days nobody thinks anything about a train accident because it happens all the time. If there were monorails all over the place, I think the safety rate would be just as impressive. It's just a great, great little system. I'm just so sad that it only goes for the short distance that it does.
Yeah, well, a few years ago they had a whole plans to extend that monorail system around the whole city, and unfortunately those plans were canceled. But
they got overly ambitious and scared people off. I mean, you look at some cities like Vancouver when they put their mass transit system in. I think they were fairly smart that they built it in stages, and rather than go to people and say we're going to build this massive thing over the next 10 years and cost $3 trillion. You said, well, we're going to build it in this phase and that phase and that phase. And it's a little more, I think, digestible for people to understand. And I think the Seattle, the most recent plan they had, was just too big, and people saw the price tags and decided, oh, my God, no, we don't want to have it. And it was unfortunate because I think if it had been built in phases or sold in phases, they might have had a much better chance of getting it.
Yeah, and then they shut down the current monorail, the one that they left over from 1962, and then when they started up again, they had lost the institutional knowledge on like how to operate it, and they ran their two monorails into each other.
Well, that was a really dumb thing that they did. The system, like anything else, was designed, you know, for one particular set of right of way, and the trains would happily pass each other, and everybody would, you know, take pictures and smile at the other train going by. Well, they decided to build a new building, and the city caved in to people and said, okay, what we'll do is we'll let your building be bigger than the track permits. So they basically put the two tracks so close together at one area that it pinches together. And the rule is you can't have two trains in that same zone of track at the same time. And unfortunately, you know, they found out the hard way. Somebody wasn't paying attention, and they tried to squeeze by each other and, you know, ended up colliding. So the original design, that never would have happened. And to be honest with you, as much as I love Seattle, I'd like to go and pound whoever made the decision to let them do that. They really took a very good design and turned it into a very bad design for reasons that escaped me.
Well, I hadn't realized that there was the change that had happened that way. I thought it was just that they had just known over the years not to do that. And
it was one of those things where both tracks, you know, had ample clearance between them. The tracks were always close enough that if anything happened, you could, you know, stop the two trains side by side, put a ramp between them, and, you know, evacuate the people from one train onto the other. But in this particular case, I forget the name of the building that they wanted to build, and they just said, hey, we need more space, and the city said, okay, and they moved one of the tracks, and everybody knew that you shouldn't have done that, but they did it anyway, and one day they unfortunately banged into each other. Hmm. So, and they've had some other minor things, you know, that brakes didn't work, and it banged into the bumper at the end of the track, and things like that, but you know, you stop and think, those cars are that's the original train still running since 1962. That's pretty impressive. So it showed that the original design was really solid.
Yeah, I love, every time I go to Seattle, I have to go up the Space Needle and I have to go on the monorail. Those are just two, I mean, you can't go to Seattle and not do those two things in my mind.
It's
part of the ritual.
It is, and I still hope, you know, someday that I'm sitting in another city riding the monorail, you know, through the traffic. I've been fortunate to do it in, you know, places like Japan and that, and I still keep thinking someday some city will have the foresight to build one here in the United States outside of a theme park.
Yeah, well, and here in California, I'm really hoping that we get our high-speed rail between Los Angeles and San Francisco in the next 10 years. Especially if we end up having a World's Fair that would happen to be right next to the tracks. But that's another story.
Yeah. Well, I live in California too, and you know the state our state is in. I'm surprised right now that we could, you know, build a station, let alone connect the tracks.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping that something happens soon with that, but that's a whole other topic. So when you were looking for the images for the book, where did you end up finding them? Because you said you kept on getting the same images over and over.
Yeah, you know, never didn't set out to purposely amass a collection of images from the fair. It's just, you know, a couple here, a couple there. And in this particular case, I happen to have two very fortunate things on eBay. Somebody was selling a bunch of pictures of, I guess it was described as Pacific Northwest, and they mentioned Seattle World's Fair construction, and the word construction caught my attention. I bought it. It was one of these things where you end up buying 800 slides and you end up with 12 that you wanted. Mm-hmm. But the 12 shots were really neat. It was a young boy visiting the construction site and wandering around looking at the base of the Space Needle and that. And one of the shots in the book particularly got to me because he's standing there next to one of the giant bolts that holds the foundation of the Space Needle, you know, together. And it was like, wow, look at the size of that thing compared to the kid. And it just kind of sparked an interest that, oh, maybe I'll get some more, you know, things that would be worthwhile. And about 3-4 weeks later, somebody had another lot on there, and it was not particularly well described, and got it, and I just said, wow. They were very big slides, much bigger than a 35-millimeter slide. And as a result, the image was, the details on them were breathtaking. And I kept taking them out of the box, and each one was better than the last one. And
wow.
I just kept, yeah, it was really, you know, it's like Christmas coming early. And there was about 75 of them in the box, and it was like, wow, wow, wow. And at the end of it, I said, you know, I think I got something here. You know, there were some really neat shots. So I started looking and contacting some other collectors. There were a few other people that were very nice and helped me with some shots from their collection of things I had mixed. And then two museums up in the Seattle area were also very helpful for filling in some of the holes. The biggest problem I had was finding good shots of the interior, just photography of the day and things like that. A lot of people, again, everybody took a picture of the Space Needle, and many people took pictures of this and that. But the interiors of the pavilions were a little tough to get, and that's why when I started taking some of these out of the box and go, that's the inside of the Canada Pavilion. Oh, my God, it's the inside of the UK Pavilion. Oh, it's the inside of the China Pavilion. It was really nice to have some interiors that I could start using for the book.
Yeah, it you know, it kind of reminds me, as I was walking around the Expo 2010 site this year, every single foot within that expo will be well documented, and historians 50 years from now will have no problem piecing together the expo site from the millions and millions of digital photos that were taken by the Chinese there. And I just think, wow, I wish we had those kind of resources back in 1962, because I'd love to see a lot of the interiors of these pavilions, which I've seen the photos of the exteriors for years, but I've never really known what was on the insides of them.
Yeah, it's very hard to find things like that, because one of the things I try to do in my book is not use stage publicity pictures unless it's absolutely necessary. From the very first one I've done, and I'm fortunate, this is the seventh one, I think, now, six or seven, I've tried to go with the viewpoint, what would the average person have seen at the fair? You know, what made it important to him, and not the press photographer for the pavilion or the fair or the sponsors or whatever. And a lot of people just didn't have the camera gear to go and take interior shots because of the lighting. You know, they didn't obviously have spotlights to put up all over the places, and you had those little flash bulbs that went pop at the time, and you had to throw them away, or whether, you know, years later, the Instamatic cubes and stuff. They just didn't do a good job inside, and the film stock was totally different, you know, very low ASA light rating. So you'd end up with an interior shot, but it'd be so blurry that, you know, you couldn't do anything with it, or it would be a picture of, you know, Johnny and Susie and, you know, smiling for the camera, but the rest of the pavilion had faded into the darkness behind them, and that was unfortunate. So I was very pleased when this one batch of slides fell my way, and there were some interiors that were beautiful. I mean, to the point I could sit there and read the signs on the wall of the Japan Pavilion and telling exactly what the, you know, model ship was, and what the photos represented, or the year that this particular building was due to be completed. I mean, they were that clear that I could read the captions and the photos on the walls.
Hmm. So there's the last time I was at the World's Fair site, in my ritual of going up the Space Needle and riding the monorail, I usually grab a bite to eat in the food court that's there, that's also left over. And I noticed in the corner there's a small World's Fair museum there. Do you know anything about that, or what their plans are for that?
No, I don't know much about it. I had seen it running through it one time, and I was trying to get some contact information, and if I did have it, I probably lost it as I, you know, went off on my next leg of the journey. But it was kind of neat to see, because, again, so many cities wouldn't even acknowledge that it was there. And to see it certainly has caught my eye.
You know, there's a lot of interest in World's Fairs, especially that particular one. And a lot of those people who sort of want to find out more information run across my expomuseum.com site and often this podcast, and will write to me with like little questions here and there. But you also run a website, worldsfairphotos.com, and I understand that you've had some great feedback from that as well.
One of the fun things about the website is people sometimes find me and want to talk about their World Fair memories. And I think one of the most interesting one was this past year where a woman wrote to me and said, "Hey, back in 1963, 64, I had my picture taken for use in the Kodak Pavilion with those giant murals they did. But I've never been able to find a copy of it, and I was never able to go to the fair and actually see it. Is there any chance you have that?" And I have several hundred pictures of the Kodak Pavilion, and I had exactly one showing a girl skipping rope on a beach, like she described it. Sent it to her in the email, and about 15 minutes later got back, "Thank you, thank you, thank you. I've been looking for it forever." That sort of thing I've really enjoyed. I've actually managed to help people find pictures of their family at the fair.
Wow.
It's kind of fun. I've only found so far one picture of me at the fair, but I keep looking, figure I was there a lot. Maybe I'll turn up more in some of them, but it's kind of fun. I like playing amateur, archaeologist or historian and putting people back with their memories. I get a lot of fragmented memories. I think I was at a pavilion that had something like this or was that, and do you have anything like that? And when you send them back a picture, people, "Oh my God, I'm 12 again." And I really, really enjoy that. I enjoy photography, and I enjoy it for the memories it invokes, not just the visual image, but also the collective memories that it unleashes on people.
I think it's really fascinating that you should mention that, Bill, because I think every World's Fair website or World's Fair webmaster has a similar story. And in fact, I get emails just now nearly all the time from people who've said that their image was used, their photograph of themselves or their house was used in advertising material for World Expo 88. Do I have the original image? And unfortunately, I don't have the vast resources and of photographs of archive photographs that you do, but nonetheless, I do get questions like that all the time, and it's very fascinating to know that people place a great deal of importance with linking their story with the success of the expo and the memories of that time as well. So yeah, it's interesting you should mention that.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. The one I had most fun, I think, was somebody had gone to Disneyland, because I also do vintage pictures of Disneyland, and they had lost their camera, and they were no memories back from whatever, say 1967, 68, something like that. And the guy said, "Do you have any pictures from 1967?" So I sent him a CD of them, and he goes, "Oh my God, I'm looking at my mother, my father, and my sister. They're all standing around at the men's room, and my sister's looking very irritated. I must have been inside." And she wanted to go ride one of the rides. And she wouldn't happen to have any pictures of me when I came out. And I had to write back and say, "Well, I don't know what you look like, But it was just, it's fun to be able to help people with stuff like that. They had been there. He had remembered all the days at the park, but they never had a tangible memory. And I really enjoyed being able to put that in his hand and be glad, able to do that.
Wow, yeah. That's fascinating. So I think we'll have to wrap things up here. We talked a little bit about the book and where you can find it. Do you have plans for any future books?
Yeah, I have plans for one more, but I don't want to say in case Arcadia turns me down and I look silly when somebody else does it. But last year I had a real burst of them. I did three last year, and I got very, very busy this year with family and my real day job and everything else. So this year just did the one, and we also have a 2011 calendar that came out. Arcadia has done calendars for the last couple of years, and they commissioned us last year, Bill Young and myself, to do one on the 64 fair. And it evidently sold very well, and that was the first one they came back and asked for the 2011 calendar series. And I just got my copies in a couple weeks ago, and I'm happy. So everybody I know is probably going to get a calendar for Christmas.
That's great.
So we'll see what comes up for next year. Like I said, I write these things when I feel I have the right amount of material. Like I'd love to do one in Hemisphere, for example. But I probably have three quarters of the pictures that I'd want to do for a book on Hemisphere, and until I have enough in my hand, I don't want to sound like an egotist or something, but I don't want to turn out a kind of a cruddy product just to meet a calendar schedule. I'd rather take my time and get it done right, and put out something I can be happy about. Because again, I'm writing these books to gratify my own memories of fairs and events and everything, and Yeah, so we'll see what the future one comes. But, yeah, I'm looking at the stacks of unscanned and ready-to-go pictures, and I see a few that might be fun to do something with.
Very cool. Of course, what I'm going to do now is go through the list of books that you've done so far, or that Arcady's done so far, and figure out which ones are missing.
yes, but remember, it's
so I wonder which one he's might be working on.
Yeah, but remember, in 64 we did a sequel.
Oh, that's true. So it could be a sequel. Wow.
And I also did the first book for Arcady outside the United States. So got to wonder about that too.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, the Expo 86 book, which we mentioned in a previous podcast, was really fantastic.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. That's probably the weakest selling one so far, and I think maybe because they don't have the same distribution network that they have up there, or maybe Canada's so sparsely populated compared to the United States. But the Expo 86 book was one of my favorite ones to do, and again, it's not selling as well as some of the others, but it's still doing okay. I just had some very nice correspondence with a fellow named Peter Spurney, who is the head of the 84 World's Fair, about the book, and he was pleased how it came out. And then he in turn got me in touch with some of his other workers from the 84 fair. And it's nice when you get notes back from the people that built these things, that ran them, and everything. And they said, hey, you told a good story. We like how it came out. And I'm a very, very big admirer of the people that can put these massive undertakings together. And, my little books are nothing compared to the projects these guys have turned out. So when you get a thumbs up from them, it's kind of gratifying.
Yeah, and I can attest that when Chinese Central Television was in the United States filming different former expo sites and talking about former World's Fairs, I know for a fact that they used some of your books for as a reference tool, certainly for 1984, which is the one that I was sort of involved in.
Yeah, they wanted to interview me in Knoxville for the segment they did there, and I said it's a little on my way, so I put them in touch with Martha, who had done the Arcadia book on that fair, and I think she did a very nice piece for them as well.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll wrap things up here. Unless there's anything either of you want to add?
No, again, I'm flattered to be on number 21 for you guys.
Yeah, and as I was looking at the information about it, so as I mentioned, it's October 21st here in the 21st century, and I was as I was looking at your book, I realized that the Century 21 exposition opened and closed on a 21st.
Pretty clever with that.
Yeah. So if I were a gambling man, now would be the time to go to Las Vegas, I guess.
I'm leaving right after this interview.
Okay. Well, thanks again for being on here. It's been great hearing about World's Fair that it happened before I was born, but I kind of feel like I went to, just because so much is left behind and I've seen so much about it. It's great to sort of see your book sort of put a new, fill in a lot of the gaps that it works sort of in my mind about it. So really appreciate you putting that together.
Oh, my pleasure. And I want to thank both of you guys for doing these podcasts. I mean, besides, giving me a chance to sell the book so I can retire early, I do listen to the others, and, it's kind of fun. There's always something, no matter how much you think you know about one of these things, you always pick up something new. And I just applaud you guys for keeping the flame alive.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll be helping California's economy along with a World's Fair in 2020 here, which you probably heard a little bit about, but looks like I might get involved in the bid on some level, but nothing to announce just yet.
Well, I'll keep my fingers crossed for you. So. I was so sad that the Expo 2017 didn't happen for Montreal. I had really gigantic hopes of, walking back into Montreal for a repeat of Expo 67, and I hope you guys in the Bay Area are able to pull this one off.
Yeah, I hope so too. And with any luck, you'll be taking that high speed rail up here to go to it.
Yeah, I'll fly my plane up there. I'll get there one way or another.
Yeah. Well, again, thanks, and thanks again, John, for co-hosting. Although, unfortunately, since it was a very American-centric conversation, you were kind of on the sidelines a little bit, but.
No, that's fine. I enjoyed myself. I certainly learned a lot too, and with the depth of knowledge that we're able to tap into with these podcasts, I think each one gets better than the one before. So thank you very much, Bill, for your kind words too. And thank you, Ertho.
Yeah, thanks.
Great. Well, I look forward to being in touch and let you know when I have another one coming.
Okay.
So, also, I'll let you know when I get up to San Francisco. I'd love to meet up with you.
Yeah, we need to finally meet in person. I get down to LA every now and then, but every time I'm down there, it's always for something very specific, so I can never deviate. But you know, one of these days, we'll have to actually meet in person. So for those of you who might be familiar with my expertmuseum.com site, I do have a small store on there where I link to products on Amazon.com as well as allposters.com. And in conjunction with this podcast, I will put front and center Bill Cotter's new book. So if you want to pick up that book or any of these other books, you can visit expomuseum.com/store. So for the rest of this podcast, I thought I would include some audio that John was kind enough to make for us when he visited the Expo 2010 site in its final week.
Well, hi, so it's a pleasure to give you a brief report from the start of the Shanghai World Expo. It's the 28th of October 2010, just a few days before the closing ceremony. I arrived in Shanghai yesterday afternoon, and it was a bit cloudy yesterday afternoon, but it was very thrilling to get on the maglev magnetic levitation train and come in at 440 kilometers an hour into the city. And then later, after I checked into my hotel, I went to the Shanghai World Financial Center and went to the 100th floor and had a look at the Shanghai from the observatory. Well, it certainly looks like modern-day Manhattan, or something surpassing modern-day Manhattan anyway. It's really quite amazing. And today is Thursday, the 28th of October. It's about 7:30 in the morning now. There's a few people lined up ahead of me, but from reports I've heard, because of the peak day admission tickets, pricing which they've introduced now for this last week, the crowd numbers have been down, and they've told me that they'll open the gates at 8 o'clock, so I'm not quite sure whether that's correct or not, because I thought that most of the pavilions would be opening at 9 and the site would open at 9, but that's what the man said. So anyway, I'll give you a report. I'm on the Puxi side of the expo site at the moment, and I've just noticed on the map that the World Expositions Museum is my first stop, so I'm going to go there first and then look at the urban best practice area after that, then catch a ferry across to the Asian zone on the Pudong side after that. So I hope to give you a report after I've been through the World Expositions Museum and heading over to the Asian zone. See you then. Bye. Hi there, so this is John again. This is my second mini report from the Shanghai Expo, Thursday, 28th of October 2010. After about an hour and a half waiting in the queue, we finally got in at 9 o'clock. That earlier report about the gates opening at 8 was incorrect. That was just the stage 2 of the line. Yes, and I made lots of friends in the queue. It was very interesting. And the World Exposition Museum was the first stop on my list. And they had a very interesting pre-show called The City of Mascots, where all of the mascots from all the various expos are on display, and they had a multimedia presentation with some of the icons of various expos as well. And they also had several significant galleries of artwork that had been presented at World Expositions in the past, as well as more iconic memorabilia type stuff as well, which was quite interesting. And then after that, I went to one of the gift shops and I bought a commemorative mug of the expo. And because it's in the last days, they said we're doing a special promotion, buy one, get one free. So I feel very lucky. And after that, the Pavilion of Footprint was just in front of us. So I thought, and since there were hardly any people on the queue, I thought I'd come in and have a look, because I really don't have that much time to see everything. But I'll just do a few of the themed pavilions and a few of the national pavilions, but I'm really here for the architecture. So I thought if I can see most of the pavilions from the outside and see some of the pavilions on the inside, I'll be happy. But anyway, this pavilion of the Footprint, which I'm in right now, is just massive, and it's a fascinating insight into the development of culture from the very early days. Upon entering, we saw some displays of ancient Mesopotamia and Indian and Greek cities. There's also recreation of the city of Troy, and also recreation of ancient Rome and Greece as well. They've even got a scale replica, an actual size replica, I should say, of the Statue of David in the ancient Rome and ancient Greek section. And all these rooms, these galleries are massive. And they go on through to more modern Chinese, well, modern, I should say, 2,000 years ago or 4,000 years ago, China and Japan and so on. And each of these galleries is really fascinating. I'll leave it there for my report from the Pavilion of Footprint, and I'll talk to you again soon. Bye.
Hi, so it's John here, and I'm with Peter Sams, Director of the Australia Pavilion at Shanghai World Expo 2010, in the Canberra Room in the Australia Pavilion. And Mr. Sams has most generously agreed to answer a few questions with regards to the Expo and the Australia Pavilion. So thank you very much, Peter. How are you?
That's a pleasure. It's nice to have you here, John, after speaking a couple of times, well, several times over the life of the project, and when Pete Ford and I spoke with you and also on the podcast, must be getting on 12 months ago now.
Yes, yes. Well, we're really wrapping up the Expo now, and we've only got 3 days left to go. What can you say about the success of Shanghai? Has it taken you by surprise, or how has it met your expectations?
Well, the first time that I heard the idea of 70 million people, I knew that that was a very big number. Strangely and predictably, the Chinese have managed to reach 70 million. The Australian Pavilion, last night reached 8 million visitors for the Australian Pavilion. Our target was 7 million, which is fantastic, and that has taken me by surprise. Australia, as I've said before, takes this expo very seriously because China is. So we're here with both boots on. We're doing the best we can with an $83 million project. And we've done pretty well. 8 million people listed as the top five pavilion, actually ranked fifth. We've had 217 business, trade, investment, education and tourism events, 450 staff who managed to have brought themselves together into a team of people to talk to our visitors, and the biggest ever cultural program that Australia's ever done. So all in all, we're pretty happy.
Yes, I saw a bit of your cultural program outside. I thought, what's the name of those trio of scuba divers that do their comedy routine? What were they called?
Well, actually, in the Australian Pavilion today, we have two sets of scuba divers with our resident group called Airborne, who do an aerial act 14, 15 metres above the ground in one part of the pavilion. But the outside street performers, they're called Chrome. They're from New South Wales, and they're perfectly suited for Expo. They get in and amongst the crowd. They entertain the people in the queue. And give everyone that smile and that moment to remember their experience at the pavilion.
Yes, certainly. I saw a lot of very happy Chinese people and camera-happy Chinese people as well looking at them and interacting with them. And I think that's part of the wonderful thing about World Expositions is that it's not always about technology, but it's really about personal exchange. And I saw that happening. And 7 million people, up to 8 million people, you must be very happy with the success of the Australia Pavilion. Can you say in a few words to what you attribute the success of the Australia Pavilion at Shanghai?
Well, I think our success comes from a few things. Because we have taken this expo so seriously, the Australian government committed funds right the way back from 2006. So we were well organised, we were well planned, and we spent a lot of time getting ready to make sure that we could be the first pavilion finished, have all of the staff in place and be ready to roll from the 1st of May. But also Australia has a good relationship with China, so people have a natural affinity with Australia, so people were keen to come and learn more about Australia. To follow that through, though, and to have an exhibit and an experience that was worth the wait meant that our numbers have actually increased during the course of Expo. Up until the point that we reached our capacity, we pulled back a little bit from capacity and we've stayed at around 48,000 people per day for the last 4 months.
And lastly, I heard that the 7 millionth visitor to the pavilion got a special gift. What was that?
Well, actually, last night, the 8 millionth visitor received a trip to Australia, and they're going to Uluru, and they're going to Sydney, and they're going to climb the bridge, and they're going to Melbourne, and they're going to look at the fairy penguins, and they're having helicopter flights, and they're doing all sorts of things. Really, with partners from Tourism Australia, we've provided a terrific trip. Following on from earlier, we did a Queensland trip for, I think it was the 5 millionth visitor, to take a couple of people up to Queensland. So we've done a few of those, as have many other countries.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. We'll wrap up there. That was Mr. Peter Sams, Pavilion Director of the Australia Pavilion at Shanghai World Expo 2010, on this special edition for the World's Fair podcast on the 28th of October 2010. We have the closing ceremony coming up in just a few days' time. I'll be here then to give you a further report, so we look forward to speak to you again then. Thanks, Erso.
At which I'll be dancing. If you look for me on the closing ceremony, I'll be on the left-hand side with a confused look on my face. Thanks.
Well,
thanks
I'm sure Australian watchers and Chinese watchers will be looking forward to that. Thank you once again, Peter, for your time and for your dedication to this project. Bye.
Well, I've just seen the Australia Pavilion and the Japan Pavilion, I must say. Both of them are equally fascinating, each in their own way. The Australia Pavilion had a wonderful introduction to Australia's history, society and culture. As you walked up through a circular ramp, you were introduced to various multimedia displays about Australia's history and society today. And then you were led into a large multimedia cinema in the round, where, courtesy of some innovative projection techniques, including some static sculptural items, and surrounding around that a revolving series of screens, which were lifted up into place and then went back down to a recessed space, and also projected onto those screens various multimedia figures, which also related to the sculptures, which kept changing and coming up out of the centre of the stage. Very interesting presentation, spanning the breadth of Australia from its geography to its industry and society, and all around the story of three children, one Chinese Australian child, one Australian child, and another child. Narrating the story to the audience, which gave it a whimsical effect. And the Japan Pavilion, a massive pavilion, also introduces oneself to the pavilion through a series of ramps where Japanese life is portrayed, and also this leads you on through to two cinema areas. In one of the cinemas, one is introduced to the story of the Japanese crested ibis, which became extinct and in China. But through Japanese technology, they were able to start a breeding program for some Japanese crested ibis, which were found in China, seven of them. And using the Japanese technology, they started this breeding program and eventually gifted some of these crested ibis back to Japan and released them into the wild as well. So a really touching story about the cooperation between Japan and Japan-China friendship and cooperation. Hi, so this is John with a quick wrap-up of the news from the closing day of Shanghai World Expo 2010. It's 31st of October 2010. Yesterday was BIE Day, and that went very, very well. The Chinese certainly know how to handle their protocol. Secretary General Lasse Chavez and also the President of the BIE and many other BIE delegates and VIPs were present. And there was a stunning three-nation cultural performance from China, from Yeosu, Korea 2012, and also from Milan 2015. After that, the BIE delegates, including myself, visited China, Korea and Italy, which is very impressive, and each of those pavilions to some extent, Korea and Italy had presentations on their future expos as well. The BIE now involve immediately prior to the BIE dinner, there was the award ceremony, and the UK pavilion got gold for its design, amongst others, and Spain came, got a bronze for its design as well. And today's been a pretty hectic day. The weather's quite fine. The numbers weren't so large in the morning, but now it's about 4:30 in the afternoon, and it's quite a big crowd. It's a very exciting day here. So wrapping up from Shanghai. Bye, Oso. Bye.
So I really appreciate John putting that together for us, and live reports from the last few days of Expo 2010, especially that great follow-up with Peter Sams of the Australian Pavilion. If you missed it, you can listen to our interview with him on Episode 3, which was recorded before the Expo opened. For more information about the World's Fair podcast, you can go to worldsfairpodcast.com, which is sponsored by Expo Museum, which is at expomuseum.com. John's Foundation Expo 88 is at foundationexpo88.org. And you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/worldsfairpodcast and select the like button there and send us a message. On Twitter, you can follow me at Expo Museum, and you can follow John at FExpo88. There are many ways to contact us. You can email me at urso@expomuseum.com, or you can email John at info@foundationexpo88.org, or you can call our question and comment line, which is at 650-ASK-EXPO. In fact, that's how John got the trip reports to us. He just picked up the phone and gave us a call. So once again, I'd like to thank John. I'd like to thank Bill Cotter for appearing on this podcast, and Peter Sams. So in upcoming episodes, we're going to have a couple great guests. Our next episode will feature Alfred Heller, who was the editor of World's Fair magazine, which ran for many years, and has attended so far 19 World's Fairs. In fact, I got to hang out with him briefly at the Expo 2010 site. And we're scheduled to talk with the Secretary General of the BIE soon, so you can look forward to that in a future podcast. As always, thanks.